So I guess first thing to say is I'm not sure how to gauge the right size to write on this blackboard. So if I'm writing too small, just tell me. Or I guess if I'm writing too big. So the basic scenario of quantum error correction is pretty simple. It involves Alice and Bob, who I imagine you've already met, the two leading Gedanken experimentalists of the field of quantum information. So in quantum error correction, we have Alice who wants to send some qubits to Bob. And the problem is they have some kind of communications channel. Maybe they're sending photons over an optical fiber or through the air. Maybe they have some sort of waveguide. Maybe they have some sort of concoction of spins. Who knows? The problem is that their communications channel is an imperfect one. So there's an environment that interacts with this channel and does stuff to it. And in quantum information, there's not really a one-way thing. So it's really kind of a two-way thing. The environment is doing stuff to the channel, but also kind of learning about the quantum states. It's not really a clean distinction between those two. So the problem is that if Alice just sticks her qubit through this into this quantum channel and Bob gets them out, then what Bob gets out will not be the same as what Alice sent. And the solution to this is, at least classically, the analogous problem occurs, of course, all the time. And the solution to it is to use an error-correcting code, where Alice wants to send classical bits to Bob. So what she's going to do is she's going to send more bits than she's actually trying to convey, and encoding the information somehow using those extra bits to add some redundancy. And then the environment causes noise, but Bob can identify what the errors are, correct them, and get back the state that Alice sent. So the simplest classical error correcting code is just the repetition code. So Alice might send, if she wants to send a single bit, that's a zero. She might send instead three bits, all zero. Or if she wants to send the one, she'll send three bits, all one. And then Bob, at the other end, might receive something like 010, okay? And he'll look at that and say, well, okay, this communications channel is noisy, but it's not that noisy. So it's more likely that it's the middle bit that got flipped than both the first and the last bit, right? So if Bob sees 010, he'll correct it to 000. And of course, if it actually was the first and the last bits that got flipped, he'll be wrong. It really was 111. So maybe we can compare whether he's actually won anything by doing this. So if we assume that there's a probability P per bit sent of error, and it's independent on the different bits, then, well, what's the probability if Alice sends just a single bit, there's a probability P that Bob will get the wrong thing. And in this case, when we use this repetition code, what is the actual probability? Well, there's a probability, 1 minus P cubed of no errors. In that case, Bob will get the right thing. And there's a probability 3p, 1 minus p squared, of one error. And in that case, Bob will still get the right thing, right? Because he'll see something like 010, and he'll correct it to 000. But then there's a probability 3p squared times 1 minus p of two errors, and of p cubed of all three errors. And in this case, Bob will see, again, something like 010, but it started out as 111. So in that case, Bob will correct it, but get the wrong answer. And in this case, Bob will see just something like 111, and he'll think it actually started as 111, when really it started as 000. And so in these two cases, Bob gets it wrong. And in these two cases, Bob gets it right. But you see that these things are order p squared and smaller. And so when p is small, less than about a third, the probability of having one of these things is much greater than the probability of having one of these. And in particular, the probability of sending it unencoded and having an error is probability p is greater than the probability of error when you send it encoded. And so that's what the error correcting code has done for you. It's changed the probability of error from order p to order p squared. When p is small, that can be a very big improvement. Okay? So this is pretty straightforward. This is classical. It's kind of obvious that this code will work and for low error rates will improve things. So how do we generalize this, modify it, whatever, to work in the quantum case? We have qubits that we want to send instead of classical bits. So you might say, okay, well, we'll just do this. We'll use a quantum repetition code. We'll take our quantum state psi, and Alice will send psi, tensor psi, tensor psi. The problem with that, of course, is that there is no quantum operation you can do that will take, that Alice can do as the encoder, to take psi into three copies of psi. Now, if she knows what psi is, she could make three copies of it just independently. But there's two reasons that's not a good idea. So first of all, she might not know what it is. And second of all, it might not even be well-defined what it is, right? Because psi could be entangled with some other qubit that's not getting sent. In that case, it's not, you know, a pure state. It's a mixed state if you look at it by itself. And even if you copy the mixed state, you won't be copying the entanglement, right? Entanglement is monogamous. So the no-cloning theorem prevents repetition. So we'll have to be a little more clever when we want to make a quantum error correcting code. Okay, so I'm going to leave you to stew in that for a little bit and take a slight break and think about what we actually want from a quantum error correcting code. In particular, what kind of errors do we have to deal with? What is a quantum error? So I don't know if anybody has already covered this. Probably you've seen this. So the most general operation that's allowed by quantum mechanics is a completely positive trace-preserving map. Now that's not completely true, right? The most general thing that's allowed by quantum mechanics is some sort of, standard non-relativistic quantum mechanics, is some sort of Hamiltonian interaction with the environment that continues over time. But in this scenario that we're thinking about here, the only source of noise is in the communications channel between Alice and Bob. So we're going to assume that Alice has a perfect quantum computer. She can do whatever encoding she likes. Bob has a perfect quantum computer. He can do whatever decoding he likes. And since the only source of noise is in the middle, we might as well assume, assuming the environment is kind of initially uncorrelated with Alice's state, then there's just kind of one step, right? You just send it here. The errors happen along with anything that you intended to happen. And that can be adequately modeled by a CPTP map. And a completely positive trace-preserving map in the Krauss representation looks something like this. You take rho, and you map it to sum over k, ak rho, ak dagger, where these Krauss operators sum to the identity. This is kind of a conservation of probability thing. And so you can think of these AKs as the individual errors that can occur in this channel. So there's some set of errors, AK. Each of them will occur with some probability, which is the trace of this term. And that's that. So in particular, if rho is a pure state, then what does this map do? It takes rho to some ak psi psi ak dagger. So in particular, you can think of what's happening here is that psi is going to ak psi. Okay. So from now on, I'm pretty much not going to talk about mixed states. I'm going to think about pure states. And if you have a completely positive map, I'm going to think about it as a mixture of different possible AKs that are occurring on the state psi. Okay? So what kind of AKs am I interested in? So one important point here is that this AK doesn't have to be unitary. Right? If you have only one term in this Krauss expansion, it does have to be unitary, because that's just saying that a one dagger A is equal to the identity. But if you have multiple terms, they don't individually have to be unitary. So really, AK could be kind of a general linear map. Doesn't have to be invertible even. That's applied to the quantum state. Now, some of the most simple ones and kind of the most basic ones are, in fact, unitary. And this, it's allowed for the AKs to be unitary. You can have a probabilistic mixture of unitaries. That's a perfectly good CPTP map. So let's look at some examples of those. So for the moment, let's think about just qubits, since that's mostly what we like to deal with in quantum computation. And so what's a kind of standard set of 2x2 matrices? So the first one you can think of is what you would think of classically as an error, which is a bit flip error. So that's an X error. And you might think of it as sigma X or sigma 1 or something like that, but I like to write it X just for convenience because it shows up a lot. And that has this matrix, 0, 1, 1, 0. So what does it do? It takes 0 to 1, and 1 goes to 0. So that's just kind of a classical thing where I've put, you know, kets around the 0 and 1. Now, of course, since it's acting on a qubit, it also acts on a superposition, right? If you started with alpha 0 plus beta 1, you get a bit flip, you'll get alpha 1 plus beta 0. But we also have to worry about kind of more quantum errors. So there's, this is sigma x, so what about sigma z, or just z? That's a phase flip error, has this matrix. And so it's taking 0 to 0 and 1 to minus 1. Okay, and again, alpha 0 plus beta 1 will go to alpha 0 minus beta 1. And then, of course, there's a third polymatrix, Y, is IXZ, which is this matrix. And this is the simultaneous bit and phase flip. And, of course, this global phase of I has no physical significance. It's just kind of mathematically convenient to have that, so that Y is Hermitian as well. Okay? So these are three pretty simple errors. They're all unitary. Now, there's other, of course, lots of other unitary matrices you could think about. Let's see, I'm running out of space here, so let's go over to the other side. So what's another unitary matrix? Just for an example, let me put up R theta here. So this is this matrix, e to the minus I theta, e to the plus I theta along the diagonal. But of course, you could do anything, right? Like I said, it could be, you know, certainly any unitary 2x2 matrix, and actually really any 2x2 matrix can be part of this Krauss representation up to scale. Then, of course, there's the possibility of non-unitary stuff happening. So, for instance, there's a dephasing map. So that's taking well, okay, so I guess I am doing density matrices here. So it's probability 1 minus p of getting rho out again, but probability p of getting a z error. Okay? And when p equals a half, this is a complete defacing map that takes a superposition alpha 0 plus beta 1 and gives you a probabilistic mixture of 0 with probability alpha squared and 1 with probability beta squared. So another map you'll frequently see in the quantum literature is the depolarizing channel, which takes rho. So again, with probability 1 minus p, you get the identity. But with probability p over 3, you each get x, y, and z. Okay. So this map is symmetric on x, y, and z. And in fact, it's completely symmetric over unitaries. Another representation. So these CPT maps don't have this representation in the Krauss operators is not unique. Unless there's only one of them. There's multiple different ways of doing it. And so this depolarizing map can also be written as a uniform mixture over unitaries. Yeah, that's right. So the defacing, I mean, they all kind of anything, well, any unital map is going to move stuff inward. The defacing map will take the block sphere and kind of shrink it towards the z-axis, okay, into an ellipsoid. The depolarizing map takes the block sphere and shrinks it uniformly, symmetric. And then maybe just to give one more example of something that's a little bit more interesting Krauss operators is the amplitude damping map. So this has two Krauss operators. And hopefully I can get this right. So let's see. So A0 is I think that's correct. I might have gotten some of the squares, and there might be a square on one of those. But the point is that it has two Krauss operators. And so the amplitude damping map, it kind of models spontaneous emission. So say you have a two-level atom, ground and excited. And occasionally, the excited state emits a photon and goes down to the ground level. And so when that happens, you get this A1 map. You see this gamma represents the probability of having this emission event, this jump event, and 1 goes to 0. And the thing is, the funny thing that you might not expect, but is required by this condition here, is that A0 is the non-jump event when there's no emission, and it's not a multiple of the identity. Instead, what it does is it kind of reweights 0 and 1. So the thing is that if there's an emission, you know that it used to be 1. But if there's not an emission, if it started out as 0, you can't have an emission event. You can't have a jump event. And so if you don't see a photon being emitted, even if you're not looking, if it doesn't happen that a photon is emitted, then it's more likely that it actually was 0 before. Okay? So even in the cases where you don't emit a photon and jump down, you still get reweighted to be more likely to be 0. That's kind of funny, but it's implied by the mathematics that you have to have something like this happen. And so what this amplitude damping map does is it shrinks the block sphere down towards the south pole, if that's your ground state. Okay? And so in particular, you see this is an example of a case where both the Krauss operators are non-unitary. And in this case, not even invertible. Okay? So maybe one more type of error that I want to mention, which kind of falls a little bit outside the scope of what I said so far, but it's kind of important in a lot of discussions of quantum error correction that you'll see in the, say, ADS-CFT context or elsewhere, is the idea of an erasure error. So so an erasure error is an error where you have 0 and 1, 0, 1, or some superposition come in, but you get out some other state per. So you're getting a qubit in, but the output is actually a three-dimensional Hilbert space. So that's allowed by these CPTP maps. I just haven't taken advantage of it so far. And the idea here, again, if you imagine Alice sending a photon to Bob, then suppose we're encoding 0 as, you know, left circularly polarized light, and 1 is right circularly polarized, then the erasure map is when the photon just gets lost along the way. It gets absorbed by the fiber or something like that. And so instead, you're seeing the vacuum, right? That's a third state. And the thing is that when you see that vacuum, you know that something happened, right? It wasn't supposed to be the vacuum. But you don't know what the state was to start with. You've erased the information. So there's definitely an error there. You just, you know that there's an error, but you don't know what exactly happened. So this is a kind of a model for located error, where some flag goes off to tell you that there's been an error, but you don't know what kind it is. Now, if you're running a quantum computer, you can always say, okay, so this photon has been erased. It's in some other state of the Hilbert space that I'm not usually using. So, but I want to deal with qubits, so I'm going to stick another qubit back in there, a new photon, and I'm just going to make it random because I don't know what it's supposed to be. Okay? So in that case, you've converted this erasure error to an error that stays within the Hilbert space, but you have some side classical information that reminds you that there actually was an error there. Okay? And that means that this type of error, this located error, is actually easier to deal with than a kind of general unknown error. Okay? Yeah? Right. It depends on your technology, obviously. So if you have, you know, separate photodetectors for each photon, well, okay. So to be really strict about this, you're receiving the photon. If you want to use that qubit to do some quantum computation, to see whether the photon is there or not, you'd have to do what's called a non-demolition measurement of whether there's a photon there or not, which means that a regular photodetector is not going to work, because a regular photodetector absorbs the photon, and then it's gone, and you can't use it for anything else. So if you do that, you can tell whether there's a photon there or not, or at least whether you detected one. The detector doesn't have perfect efficiency. But if you do a non-demolition measurement, then you can see that it's there. And so if you do separate non-demolition measurements for each of the photons, then yes, you can see which ones got lost and which ones didn't get lost. Now, if instead you put them through some, you know, complicated optical circuit or something like that, and then at the end you just kind of count up the number of photons you have, then no, you don't necessarily know which one got lost, and you'll have to take that into account. Yeah. Yeah. So frequently what will happen in this erasure channel is it will be a CPTP map with probability P of having this erasure event and probably 1 minus P of having the identity. So this is what it is formally, and that's on a single qubit. And so if you have multiple qubits, you just take the n-fold tensor product of that, and you do the same calculation that I did before, where you say, oh, the probability, if there's 3 of them, what's the probability of having 1 erasure somewhere in there? It's 3, exactly 1. It's 3p, 1 minus p squared. Oh, yeah, so, right, so, 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 Right, sure. So that's something that you can put in yourself. And the thing is, what you're doing is a CPTP map as well, but it's one that leaves the original Hilbert space. If you put in a state in the original Hilbert space, it's unchanged. And if you put in something in this orthogonal subspace, it just gets mapped to a random state. Okay? And maybe the way to deal with that is to say, okay, I'm gonna add an extra qubit, that's my flag. So this will let's call this rho e. And so I'm gonna take rho e and map it to I have to think about what a good notation for this is. But I mean, what we're doing kind of is you have if you have the projector on the computational Hilbert space, then rho e, I guess, is going to pi rho e pi plus plus the max. And then there's a this one you get a flag on your ancilla to tell you that there was no erasure, and then if you have the orthogonal state, let's see, then you get out and you get out the maximally mixed state. Yeah, and this is gonna be tensored with 1-1 on the ancilla. I'm just trying, this is not the right thing here, but something like this. This is supposed to say, if you project on the pi state, then you get out the maximally mixed state. And then the ancilla is 1-1, is one. And I'm just, you know, trying to write down the right thing here is probably too much of a digression right now. Okay, so the point is that's an allowed quantum operation, right? And it's in this case it's easier to think of it not in this Krauss form, but just as a circuit. What do? Well, you say, well, I'm going to measure it to see if it's perp or not, and if it's perp, I'm going to stick in some random state. Okay, so those questions actually reminded me of something that I meant to say before but forgot to. In the classical repetition code or in the quantum code, it's still this kind of same formula of suppose we have n qubits and we have a probability p of error per qubit. Well, the probability of having one error somewhere in there is order p, although it'll scale with n. The probability of having two errors is order p squared. The probability of having three errors is order p cubed. So when p is small enough, we say, well, two errors is unlikely compared to one error. And so when we're talking about error-correcting codes, frequently what we do is we just say, okay, let's assume that there's only at most one error. Okay? And the logic behind that is what I've said, that, well, the probability of two errors is small. So we'll kind of neglect that. Or maybe you're not satisfied with just one error, you might say, well, let's assume there's the most t errors. Since the probability of t plus one errors is order p to the t plus one, you say that's small enough that I want to neglect it. Okay? And so when we deal with quantum error correcting codes, we're not going to do this calculation every time. We're just going to say, oh, this is a code that corrects one error. And therefore, that's good. Okay, that's what we're looking for. Okay, and we won't even consider really what happens when two errors. I mean, we might consider it, but it's not the main concern. Okay. So with that out of the way, we know about quantum errors. So now I want to to move towards the main topic and talk about how to get rid of these quantum errors, how to make a quantum error correcting code. But as we've seen, which I guess is going to be stuck in the middle of the board for a while, there are some issues in making quantum error correcting codes. So one of them, of course, as we said, is that the no cloning theorem says, well, you can't just repeat the quantum information. And since that seemed like it was kind of the cornerstone of classical error correction, that's going to be a challenge. Moreover, as you think about it some more, you can come up with some other issues that might arise when trying to make a quantum error correcting code. So if you remember what I said the correction process was for the repetition code, well, I said Bob will look at the state and see, oh, the middle bit has been flipped. Okay? But that's a problem in the quantum case, right? You can't, if Bob receives some number of qubits and he looks at them, well, he's destroyed the superpositions, right? You're trying to preserve superpositions. That makes it, that's what makes a qubit special, different from a classical bit. And so looking at it, destroying the superpositions is kind of going to ruin the whole point. So, so that's problem two. Let me make some more space for myself here. Problem two is, how can we measure the error without destroying superposition? Okay. Now, even if we can solve those two problems, it's still clear that quantum error correction is going to be a lot more challenging than classical error correction. Classically, we only had to deal with bit flip errors. Quantumly, we also have to deal with these other Pauli errors, phase flips as well. And in fact, there's this whole infinite spectrum of other possibilities. I mean, this family R theta alone is itself an infinite set of errors. Not to mention these ones that decohere the state. Okay. So we have our work cut out for us. I mean, looking at this list of problems, you might say, well, this seems unlikely that we're going to be able to solve all these problems. Maybe we should give up. Of course, I have 3 hours of lectures on quantum error correction, so you know that's probably not going to be the right answer. But let's start small. We're not going to try to solve all these problems at once. Let's instead focus on the first couple of problems and think again about that classical repetition code. So this classical repetition code protected a classical bit against bit flip errors. So maybe we can do something similar that's going to protect a quantum bit against bit flip errors. So how are we going to do that? Well, why not just use the classical repetition code again? So we'll make it quantum by putting kets around everything. So instead of encoding the bit zero as three zeros, we're going to encode the ket zero as a ket with three zeros. And one will go to 111. Okay? But the linearity of quantum mechanics implies that if we want to encode the basis states 0 and 1 in this way, we have to encode the superposition alpha 0 plus beta 1 as alpha 0, 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, 1. And so you see, this is how we get around the no cloning theorem, right? Because this is not three copies of alpha 0 plus beta 1. We are copying it, but only in one basis. And when alpha and beta are both non-zero, this state here, this is an entangled state. So instead of making a tensor product of three things, we're making an entangled state that kind of still has some redundancy, at least in the computational basis, which is all we're trying to protect right now. Okay? So that solves this particular problem. We can kind of spread the information out in an entangled state without actually repeating it. Okay? Okay, so how does this correct bit flip errors? So suppose we have an x error, say on the second qubit here. So if we have x2 times this state, well, this is going to be alpha 0, 1, 0 plus beta 1, 0, 1. Right? And the thing is about this state is that the middle qubit is different from the first and the last qubits in either branch of the superposition. Okay? Now, if we were to look at it and say, oh, this middle qubit is 1 while the first and last are 0, then we'd have collapsed the superposition. But just saying that the middle qubit is different doesn't tell us anything about whether we had a logical 0 or a logical 1. So what we want is a way to measure that the middle qubit is different without learning anything else. Actually, that's not completely true. We want to learn if the first qubit is different or if the third qubit is different. Because those are the things that tell us where the error is. So let's come up with a quantum circuit that does that. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the three qubits here that are the three qubits of the code, and we're going to use two extra qubits, two ancilla qubits. And how do we determine which qubit is different? Well, we can look at the first two qubits and say, are those two things the same or different? And so we can do that by taking a controlled NOT gates. So this symbol here represents the controlled NOT. From the first two qubits here to the first qubit of first ancilla qubit. So what we're doing is we're saying for the control dot, if this one is 0, then we'll flip this bit. If this one is 0, we'll flip this bit. Sorry, if this one is 1, we'll flip this bit. If this is 1, we'll flip this bit. If both of them are 0 or both of them are 1, this qubit will end up as a 0. But if one of them is a 0 and one of them is a 1, they're different, then that qubit will end up as a 1. And so we're going to measure this ancilla. And similarly, we can see if the second and third qubits are the same with two controlled knots to the second ancilla. And so these two measurements here give us two classical bits, which are called the error syndrome. Okay? And so what are the possibilities here? So if the error syndrome is 0, 0, that means that the first two bits are the same, the second and third bits are the same. All three bits are the same. That's what we associate with no error. But suppose we see 1, 0, right? So what does that tell us about the error? In the first qubit, right? Because the second and third bits are the same, so it couldn't really be either of those. But the first one is different, so that means the first one must have had an error. And similarly, if we have 0 and 1, that means it's the third qubit that has the error. And then 1, 1 is the example I started with where the second qubit is different from both the first and the third. Okay? So looking at these two bits of the error syndrome lets us identify where the error is. But you'll notice that we get these same results regardless of what the logical state is, whether it's a logical 0 or a logical 1. So this circuit is telling us about the error, but telling us nothing about the encoded state. It doesn't collapse the logical superpositions. Okay? So that's how we solve the second problem. We measure the error and not the data. We can separate them out. Okay? And the idea of coming up with a quantum error correcting code is to figure out a way of encoding the information so these two things do get separated. Yeah, so typically what will happen then is you'll say, oh, well, there was a bit flip on the second qubit. I'll just do another bit flip and get back the original state. Or maybe you don't even bother with that and just say, I'll remember that there was a bit flip on the second qubit and go from there. Sometimes that's more convenient. So for the moment, let's just focus on this case of the bit flip error. And you'll see that there isn't actually a collapse. Because if there was a specific bit flip error that happened, you always get the appropriate answer here. Yeah, okay, well, we'll talk about that later. For now, I just want to focus on correcting bit flip errors. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. So, I mean, I said I wanted to focus on correcting bit flip errors, but actually I'm done focusing on bit flip errors. And now let's move on to the next step. I'm not quite ready to tackle this problem three. So let's come up with a code that corrects phase errors, but not bit flip errors. Okay, we had a code here that corrects bit flip errors, but not phase errors. So let's do the opposite. Okay, so it's going to be very similar to this bit flip code. And in fact, it takes advantage of the fact that the Hadamard rotation will map you from the zero basis, 0, 1 basis, to the plus minus basis. So this is 0, +1. And the thing is that in this 0, 1 basis, the x is the bit flip. It takes 0 to 1 and 1 to 0. And the z is a phase flip. It takes 0 to 0 and 1 to minus 1. But in this plus minus basis, the roles are reversed. Right? The z will take plus to minus. Right? It takes 0 plus 1 to 0 minus 1 and 0 minus 1 to 0 plus 1. Whereas x, well, what does it do? It takes 0 plus 1 to itself. And it takes 0 minus 1 to minus itself. So the x is a phase flip. So H switches the role of X and Z. And so what that means is that if we write down this repetition code in the Hadamard rotated basis, the plus minus basis, in the original basis correct bit flip errors, so now it'll X errors, so now it'll correct Z errors. So we're going to encode 0 as 3 pluses. And 1 as 3 minuses. Okay? And then if we just do some analog of that circuit with all the C naughts rotated into the Hadamard basis, the X basis, then we can say, oh, you know, one of these three pluses or minuses is different than the other two. And that will identify the phase error, the Z error that happened. Okay? So I don't have to go through the whole argument again. It's just the same. It's just everything is in a different basis. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay. So now the thing about these codes, I said this is a code that corrects bit flip errors but not phase errors. This is a code that corrects phase errors, but not bit flip errors. It's actually worse than that, because this is a code that corrects bit flip errors, but it makes phase errors worse, right? So if you go back to that argument, I said, well, what's the probability of having two bit flip errors? That's what causes this to fail against bit flip errors. It's order p squared. But what's the probability, but if you have even a single phase error on any of the three qubits, that will ruin this, the superposition, right? It'll go from alpha 0, 0, 0 minus beta 1, 1, 1 on any of the three qubits. And the probability of that happening is about 3 times p, you know, plus something order p squared. So while the bit flip errors have gone from p to p squared, the phase errors have gone from p to about 3p. They're more likely. And similarly, this one takes the bit flip errors from p to about 3p. Okay? So it seems like, looking at these two codes, it seems like there's a trade-off between bit flip and phase errors. But the thing is that this is improving the bit flip errors more than it makes the phase errors worse, at least for low p. And similarly here. And so what we can do is we can come up with a code that does both of them. And so that's the 9-qubit code. Or at least I'll start with the 9-qubit code. And so the 9-qubit code is going to encode a 0. So I frequently use this line over the basis label to indicate that it's a logical state, an encoded state in a quantum error correcting code. And so the logical 0 is going to be 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1. Tensor 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1. Tensor 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1. So a tensor product of three copies of 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1. And the logical 1 is going to be the same thing, but with minuses. 0, 0, 0 minus 1, 1, 1 three times. And then, as usual, the superposition, alpha 0 plus beta 1, is going to get encoded as alpha times this thing plus beta times this thing. Okay? And so staring at this, and I guess on Friday we'll talk a little bit more about exactly how to do the error correction, although, again, not in complete detail. Staring at this, you can maybe see that it can correct a bit flip error and a phase error. So if you have, for instance, a bit flip error, by looking at each set of three here and seeing which qubit is the same or different from the other ones, which qubit is different from the other two in the standard basis, you can see if there's been a bit flip error in that set of three and correct it. And then by comparing the three phases, and that's the part that's just a little bit more involved, you can say, oh, one of the three phases is different from the other two. And again, without measuring exactly what those phases are, you can see that it's different. And that will let you identify where there's been a phase error and correct that. Okay? So this is something that corrects a bit flip error and or a phase error. Okay? And actually, they're kind of two separate processes. So it corrects both at once. And in particular, it corrects a Y error as well. Okay, so we kind of got that Y for free in this particular case. So that solved this problem number three. So we have something that actually corrects kind of a bunch of different quantum errors, X, Y, and Z. But in order to do that, we had to go from 3-qubit code up until something bigger, 9-qubit code. Before I go on, are there any questions on that? Yeah?
Just to
That's right. So in the problems, if you do the problem-solving session today, I have some kind of exploring what happens if you have multiple errors in this case. But certainly, there are certain cases where you can correct multiple errors. If you have, you know, a bit flip and a phase error on a different qubit, that's fine. So what you're doing is you're going to look at each set of three and say, can I correct bit flip errors on here? And you do it for all three sets. You don't say, well, I found one and so I'll stop. You might as well do all three, right? And then you do it for the phase errors. So in some cases, you'll be able to correct two errors. In some cases, you won't. Exactly. So Y is still a single qubit error that does involve both a bit flip and a phase. So it'll show up in both of these parts. You kind of correct it in two pieces. Sorry, is it obvious that you can correct it? No, it doesn't have to be on separate bits. So what I said was that the bit flip process, correction process here is completely separate from the phase error correction process. And so that lets you correct a bit flip and a phase error, whether they're on the same qubit or different qubits. Usually, I mean, if they're on the same qubit, that's usually easier. Because, I mean, if you start to couple the processes, you can have some information pass between them. And in particular, there's fewer cases where there's just a Y error on one qubit rather than a bit flip on one and phase error somewhere else. No. So the smallest code that will correct a single XYZ error on a single on one qubit is 5-qubit code, and I'll show you that on Friday. Okay. Any other questions on this 9-qubit code? Okay. So we solved the first three problems, but this fourth one might seem like it's kind of difficult, right? In order to go from correcting just bit flip errors to both bit flip and phase errors, we had to go from 3 qubits to 9 qubits, or at least to 5 qubits. But does that mean that if we want to correct an infinite set of errors, we're going to have to go to infinitely many qubits? That would be kind of bad. So instead of trying to make some other special code for these other types of qubits, let's kind of study this 9-qubit code a bit more and see what happens to it if we have some other error. Like, let's pick one of these continuous phase rotations. So suppose we have r theta, which, remember, looked like this. Well, the thing is, we can write this as a superposition of errors that we're already familiar with, or that we've already been dealing with. Because this is equal to cosine theta times the identity minus I sine theta times z. By the linearity of quantum mechanics, that means we can pretty quickly analyze what's going to happen to our quantum error correcting code if we have something like this. So this was the question about superposition of errors. Now we're tackling it head on. So we have the code word psi, and suppose we have r theta applied to the kth, to the, let's call it the jth qubit. Okay? So what is that? Well, that's cosine theta times the identity applied to psi minus I sine theta z on the jth qubit applied to psi. Okay. So now what does our error correction process do? So what we're going to do is we're just going to kind of be stupid and do the same error correction process we used for x, y, and z, but actually this is the error that occurring. We didn't know that this is the error that occurring. We were just assuming that it was x, y, and z, and we're going to go ahead with that assumption and see what happens. So what happens? So what does the error correction do? Well, you add a bunch of ancilla qubits, and those ancilla qubits are supposed to identify which poly error we had. right? So when there's the identity, that's supposed to go to an error syndrome of zero. Okay, so this is the syndrome register. And when there's a Z error, that's supposed to go to the syndrome that says, well, there's a Z error on qubit J. Okay? So that's what I mean by this ket with ZJ. That's whatever syndrome corresponds to Z error on qubit J. Okay? And if we have a superposition of those two by the linearity of quantum mechanics, we have to have the same superposition of these two things. So we get cosine theta times this minus I sine theta times this. The syndrome is multiple qubits. In this case, it turns out to be 8 qubits. Okay? So what's the next step? The next step is we measure those qubits to actually see what the syndrome is. And in this case, we do have a collapse because we have a superposition of different values for the error syndrome. And so with probability cosine theta squared, we're going to get this branch, right, where we see I psi 0 in the syndrome. And with probability sine squared theta, we get this other branch where we see zj psi zj in the syndrome. Okay? And so look at what's happened here. So at the end, we either have, with some probability, the identity error, and the syndrome is telling us that there was no error, or we have the error zj, and the syndrome is telling us that we had the error zj. So we started with this superposition of two different kinds of errors, but by going ahead with this error correction process, we ended up with a Pauli error. It's kind of a triumph of wishful thinking. By pretending there was a Pauli error, we actually made it true. Okay? So no, the collapse doesn't hurt you. It actually helps you. It lets you take this infinite set of errors and collapse it to a finite discrete set that you've already known how to deal with. Okay? So this is kind of the big miracle of quantum error correction that makes it work. Yeah, so all you're measuring is a syndrome, right? It's like a little bit like this circuit here, right? You interact the code block, data qubits, with some ancilla qubits. The ancilla qubits kind of register what the syndrome is, and then you measure it to see what it is. It totally makes sense, right? So if theta is very close to zero, so it's a very small rotation, right? That theta is from here, right? So when theta is small, this is very close to the identity. And so with high probability, you'll get the identity map. When theta is large, then with high probability, you'll get this z. And it's the error is a big error. So that makes sense. Well, the point is So in either case here, you see the state of the code gets collapsed to what you would have gotten if you just had the appropriate error on the code. So from here you say, oh, well, I measured the zero syndrome, so I won't do any correction. I'll get back to state psi without doing anything. In this case, you'll say, oh, I have a ZJ error. That's what the syndrome told me. So I'll correct it by doing ZJ. And then again, you get back the original code state. So the thing that collapses is only the error. The code word wasn't touched. And the reason it wasn't touched is because when we measured the syndrome, we didn't learn anything about the encoded state. That's right. Yeah. Okay? So are there any more questions about this? kind of an important point. Okay, so if you think about it, you can see that this generalizes, right? There was nothing special about this particular linear combination of errors. And so you have a general property, and there's nothing really special about the 9-qubit code in here either, right? So you have a general property that a quantum error correcting code, so that's almost always abbreviated QECC, quantum error correcting code, that corrects two errors E and F, also corrects any superposition, alpha E plus beta F. Okay? And a corollary of this is that a quantum error correcting code that corrects single qubit X, Y, and Z errors corrects a general 1-qubit error. Why is that? Well, so actually, I should also correct the identity here. It has to correct I, X, Y, and Z. And I, X, Y, and Z, they form a basis for the space of 2x2 matrices. So any 2x2 matrix can be written as a superposition of I, X, Y, and Z. So if you correct I, X, Y, and Z, like the 9-qubit code does, then you can correct any 2x2 matrix. And you remember that even if you have a general CPTP map, you can think of that as a mixture of different matrices AK occurring on the pure state side. Right? AK could be, doesn't have to be unitary, but it does have to be a 2x2 matrix if you're getting a qubit output. Even if you get something else, like an erasure error, you can restore it to the original Hilbert space and get an overall effect of being a 2x2 matrix. Okay? So the upshot is that this 9-qubit code really is a true quantum error correcting code. It corrects not just X, Y, and Z, but it corrects any single qubit error. So that solves problem 4 here. That included decoherence. So, yeah, so let me repeat the argument. So remember the general thing is this CPTP map. Rho goes to sum over k, ak rho, ak dagger. And this we can think of as the state psi going to some mixture of ak psi over different k's. So for instance, decoherence, pure decoherence, where you have just a superposition that becomes a mixture with some probability, is the same as this dephasing map. And so one way of writing that is say, well, there's some probability of a Z error happening. And so that's actually a very simple case. You only need to correct Z errors. More complicated things like this amplitude damping, well, you will have non-trivial maps for this AK that are not unitary, but we can write them. There's still 2x2 matrices in that I wrote them down for you. And so we can expand them as I, X, Y, and Z. One of them will occur, assuming there's only 1 qubit that has this happen to it, then we can write a superposition of I, X, Y, and Z, and the error correcting code will take care of it. Yeah, that's a single AK. So if you have a mixture of different AKs, but you correct all of them, no matter what happens, you're covered. Right? In this case, you're correcting any 2x2 matrix. So if your CPTP map is only affecting 1 qubit, that's the only thing that has error, then you're set. So maybe there's one more case that's interesting to consider. So I mean, so I was kind of loading things by saying, well, we only have one qubit that has errors on it, right? When there's actually many qubits and all of them could potentially have errors. Now, in the case of probabilistic errors where I have some probability, small probability of having an error, I've already discussed that, right? I said the probability of having two errors is order p squared. And in general, you can kind of do something similar for CPTP maps that are close to the identity. But let me show you one particular example of how that works. And suppose we have these R theta maps applied to every qubit, but theta is small. So we're going to do R epsilon tensored n times. Okay? So this is the sort of thing that we kind of hope to be able to correct with the quantum error correcting code. Every qubit has an error, but it's a small error on every qubit. For simplicity, let's say yes. That's not at all important to this argument. But it's definitely going to make what I write much easier. Okay, so what does this look like? Well, we can expand this. Each R epsilon, we can expand in terms of epsilon, right? So we have the identity plus the order epsilon terms. So we have R, So what we're going to do is we're going to look at this expansion here. And so it's going to be, you know, psi plus order epsilon z. So the order epsilon term here will be z on the first qubit plus z on the second qubit plus z on the third qubit plus dot, dot, dot. Then there's an order epsilon squared term, which will have some, you know, epsilon squared correction for this part, but also the things where we have two z's. Okay? And then, of course, there's higher order terms as well with three z's and four z's and five z's. But the point is that this thing is a superposition of a bunch of different things. And all of the terms on the first line here individually are things that we can correct with, say, the 9-qubit code. Or just in general, any quantum error correcting code that corrects a single qubit error. Okay? So by this theorem over here, if we just have this error on the first line, we'll be able to correct that error as well. But by linearity, of course, we'll also have this term on the second line, but it stays order epsilon squared. It doesn't get bigger. That's maybe unitarity that we're using there. So that means that the state after the error correcting code is correct to order epsilon squared. Whereas if we just sent it unencoded, we'd have this R epsilon, and it would only be correct to order epsilon. So this is kind of the same idea as we had before. We're seeing that the error correcting code improves the error rate by kind of getting rid of the single qubit errors and leaving only the less likely, or in this case, lower amplitude, 2-qubit errors. Okay? Yeah. Okay, so that's not quite right, right? There's the 1-qubit errors are already quite likely in that case, but the 2-qubit errors is actually 9 choose 2 ways of having 2-qubit errors. So yeah, so that's but and then times 1/9 squared. So 1/9 is kind of about the borderline, and if you have an error rate that's too high, those combinatoric factors in front mean that you're actually losing by encoding the error-correcting code. That the extra qubits mean that more errors are more likely than they were before. But if the error rate is lower, if it's not 1/9, but, you know, 1 out of 100, then you're definitely winning by doing the error correcting code. And so that's kind of what happens in general, is that there's some, well, so even in the full context where you're dealing with fault tolerance and your gates are imperfect, stuff like that, there's a threshold error rate. And if you can get below that threshold error rate, error correction, fault tolerance will work, and you can make the logical error rate really low. And if you're above that, then it's not going to work. And then you're kind of out of luck. You have to tell the experimentalists to work harder and get the error rates lower. Okay? Okay. Oh, yeah. Unless somehow you knew, I mean, if it's unitary and you know what the unitary is, you don't even need an error correcting code if you wait for the whole thing to evaporate. Now, if you only wait for part of it to evaporate, then that's an erasure error because there's some qubits that didn't come out. And we haven't totally talked about correcting erasure errors separately from general errors. But if you get a large enough fraction, then you'd be able to correct that. You can say, well, the ones that aren't there, I'll just replace them by some random bits. And now, hopefully you encoded the dictionary in a quantum error correcting code before you threw it in. And then maybe you have some hope of getting it back. But you still have to know what the unitary is that scrambled everything. Otherwise, you're totally out of luck. So far I've only talked about one error correcting code. This is a code that corrects only one error with 9 qubits. You can make bigger quantum error correcting codes that, for one thing, this also only encodes one logical qubit. You can make bigger codes that encode many logical qubits in the code, and you can make bigger codes that correct more errors. So in the asymptotic case, what you'd really like to do, and you can do this, in fact, in the communications context, is have a big quantum error correcting code that has a large number of logical qubits, but also corrects a large number of errors. That's kind of a constant fraction of the total number of qubits you're using. And it turns out you can come up with codes that do that. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so then I want to move on to talk about more general quantum error correcting codes. And in particular, come up with some conditions that let us tell if an encoding that we're given is a quantum error correcting code. So the basic idea is we're gonna kind of do the same sort of thing for general quantum error correcting code, right? We're gonna take this code. We're going to, in order to do error correction, we're going to interact it with an ancilla to try to learn something about the errors, and then we're going to measure the ancilla to figure out what the syncrome is. And so what we can do is we can say, okay, it's enough, remember, to restrict attention to Pauli errors, right? That's what this theorem says. This is for general quantum error correcting codes. So let's just restrict attention to Pauli errors. And so we'll have a bunch of different Pauli errors, and under what conditions can we measure and figure out what the Pauli error is? Pauli error, P-A-U-L-I. Yeah. So X, Y, and Z. So under what conditions can we figure out what it is? And once we know what it is, we can correct it. So what we need, so we have the states, let's call them EA psi I. Okay? So psi I are going to be the basis states for our code. Basis code words. And EA are the set of possible errors. Or at least the ones that we're worried about, the X, Y, and Z. If all of these different states are orthogonal to each other, then there's definitely some measurement that we can make that will tell us what value of A we have. So it's sufficient if EA psi I is perpendicular to EB psi J for all A, B, I, and J. Well, A not equal to B, I not equal to J. And actually, it's either A is not equal to B or I is not equal to J. So what does that mean in another way? That's saying that psi I, EA dagger, EB psi J is equal to delta AB, delta IJ. Okay? Yeah. So this is, so if this is true, then we can make some measurement that will tell us what the error is, and then we can correct it. So this means that we have a quantum error correcting code to correct this set of errors. Okay? Okay, so yeah. We can. Right now, I'm just going to in my lectures, I'm just going to focus on the exact case. Making codes that are kind of approximate in various different senses is kind of challenging. Now, obviously, in the case where you have errors, that sometimes there's too many errors, then it will only work with some probability, which is the probability of having few enough errors that you can correct it. If you make this restriction that, you know, this is a set of possible errors and there's nothing outside it, then it'll be exact. But you can certainly make codes that will, you know, even if nothing happens, will not exactly recover the initial state. It turns out that these conditions don't really carry over to that case very well. And so it's kind of an open question if there's some good analog of them. Yeah. No. So in this case, all I'm worried about is errors in the communications channel, okay, between Alice and Bob. On Bob's side, he has a perfect quantum computer. The ancillas are coming in there, so he doesn't have to worry about errors. Now there's a whole much more elaborate theory of fault-tolerant quantum computation, where you do have to worry about errors on the ancilla. You have to worry about errors in the gates you're using for error correction. You have to worry about errors in the gates you're using in encoding. And you can take care of all of that, but it is much more complicated. I'm not going to have time to talk about it. And so far, it hasn't been totally relevant to the subject of the It for Qubit workshop, although that doesn't have to be the case in the future, obviously. Yeah. A question from online. Oh, okay. So the question, that question was, do we have to worry about errors in the ancillas? Sorry, I don't remember all the previous questions, but I'll try to remember to do it in the future. Are there any other questions now that I can remember to repeat? Okay, so this is a sufficient condition. So is it a necessary condition? It turns out it's not quite necessary. So the actual sufficient and necessary condition is this. So quantum error correcting code with basis psi I corrects the set of errors E if and only if psi I EA dagger EB psi J is equal to CAB delta IJ. Okay? So it's very similar, but we've replaced this delta AB with some general matrix. And the main point of this condition is that the CAB here doesn't depend on I and J. So you have kind of a separation between the logical qubits and the errors, which is what you needed to do the error correction. OK. So let's see. So what time is it? So I'm kind of low on time, so I'm not going to go through a whole proof, but which isn't particularly complicated. But I do want to say how you get from here to here, sort of. Is C, the question is C invertible? And the answer is no, it doesn't have to be invertible. And that's a very interesting case, which I'll get to in a second. So, but if suppose you have this condition, it's very easy to see that it's sufficient, given what we've already done. So why is that? Well, if you look at this side, this left-hand side, you'll see that it's Hermitian. I mean, that if you take the complex conjugate, CAB has to be Hermitian, right? And so if C is Hermitian, it means it's diagonalizable. And remember, if we can correct the set of errors E, we can correct any superposition of those, and vice versa. So what we can do is we can change the basis of errors that we're working in to diagonalize CAB. Okay? And so if you diagonalize CAB, then it's going to look a lot like this. Now, it'll have some eigenvalues that are different. That's OK. That corresponds to the different probabilities of having those different errors. And in particular, if it has zero eigenvalues, then those are errors that have zero probability of occurring. Why is that? Well, when this is diagonal, let's plug in CAA. Well, that's EA dagger EA, right? And to get anything non-zero, you have I equals J as well. And so that's psi I EA dagger EA psi I, which is the probability of having EA kind of occur on the state psi I. OK? So zero eigenvalues mean this error actually doesn't occur. So that's something that we can't really invert, but it also doesn't happen. So it's not a problem. Yeah?
Just to clarify, so that the EAs are a basis of possible errors, and the actual word in this kind of continuous case where any superposition of
the right. Right. So, okay. So our original idea was that these are the errors that are kind of physically likely errors. Okay. But we know from this that we might as well take the linear span of that and say that the set of errors that this code can correct is a linear span of some original set of errors. And within that, we can just pick any basis that we like to work with. It's kind of whatever is easiest. And in that case, we can diagonalize the CAB and get back to this thing. And then we can measure in that basis of errors to figure out what the error is. And there's one other aspect of this, which is those errors might on the whole Hilbert space, those errors might not be invertible errors. But on the code space, they have to be, right? Because these states are form the states EA psi I will form not necessarily a normalized basis, but orthogonal basis, right? All of them different, so there's going to be some unitary map that gets them back. And moreover, they all have the same norm. That norm might not be one, but they do all have the same norm as a consequence of this condition. All the psi i's end up with the same norm for EA. Sorry, I guess I'm going through more of the proof than I really intended to. But that's the basic idea. And these conditions are sufficient and necessary. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's right. That's exactly why you need it. So the question was, why do you need the CAB independent from I? This was also part of the question, which is it because otherwise you won't be able to reconstruct the right ratio of psi I and psi j? And in particular, if you have a superposition of psi I and psi j, and CAB were to depend on that, then kind of the relative size of them would get distorted by the error, and you wouldn't be able to recover that. Okay, so the other thing that's interesting about these zero eigenvalues is that this is a phenomenon that doesn't really occur in the classical case. In the classical case, if you have different errors, they'll always definitely do different things to the code. But if CAB doesn't have maximum rank, that's saying that you have different errors that maybe do the same thing to the code, or at least do linearly dependent things to the code. So the errors acting on the whole Hilbert space are linearly independent, but acting on the code space, which is some, you know, weird subspace inside this big Hilbert space, acting on the code space, they become linearly dependent. And so that's called the degenerate code. And it's kind of a sort of big difference in the coding theory from the theory of classical error correcting codes. It makes things substantially more complicated in some cases. Okay, so for the last few minutes, I wanted to discuss applications of these error correcting conditions a little bit more. So let's see, the first thing is to define the distance of a code. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So frequently when we say what's a quantum error correcting code, we just say it's a subspace of the Hilbert space, of a big Hilbert space. So there's a physical Hilbert space, there's a logical Hilbert space. The logical Hilbert space is isomorphic to the subspace. Okay. So for instance, there might be k encoded qubits, so you have a 2 to the k dimensional subspace. With n physical qubits, it's a 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space. Now, strictly speaking, you probably should also include the isomorphism, the encoding map, that maps you from this logical Hilbert space into this subspace. But the thing is that these error correction properties don't actually depend on that at all. Okay? So the ability to correct a set of errors only depends on the subspace. It doesn't depend on your specific choice of encoding map within the same subspace. And so that's kind of one reason why we usually don't think about that. Yeah. The
only other mathematical component that has to go with it is the set of errors that you correct. Right? Because any subspace is a quantum error correcting code in some sense. It's just maybe for a weird set of errors that you don't care about. But yeah, it's really just that. It's a subspace. And the extra structure of how it's encoded, all that stuff is secondary. Yeah? The error is E? So the question was, do we require them to be orthogonal to each other? E could be just any set of errors, but like I said, because of this, we can assume that we can look at the linear span of E, so it's a linear space of errors. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so frequently this set of errors that we consider does have a particular structure, which is it's, say, all one qubit errors. Or maybe all 2-qubit errors or all t-qubit errors. And again, it's sufficient to consider all t-qubit Pauli errors, because those form a basis for the space of 2 to the t by 2 to the t matrices. And so motivated by that, we define something called the distance of the code.
the distance of a quantum error correcting code is the minimum weight of an operator F such that psi I f psi j is not equal to cf delta ij. So the minimum weight of f for which you don't have this separation between the logical indices and something depending on the error. So what's the weight? The weight is just the number of qubits that the operator acts on. Okay? So this is saying how many qubits do you have to act on before, well, this version of the quantum error correction conditions fails. Now there is something different here, right? This is just one F here. Here we have EA dagger EB. Okay. But the point is, this EA dagger EB is some operator. So the idea is, what's the smallest operator we have to have in the middle there that this equation doesn't work? Okay. Sorry? Yeah, so long as it's independent of I and j. I mean, if it's equal to zero independently of I and j, then it's equality. So it's not an example of an error that causes distance. So the question was, can CF be zero? I don't remember. So the question is, what does this mean? And it means that, I mean, there's multiple ways in which this could fail, in which equality could fail. But basically, what it has to mean is that it could be that F is making, F psi j is not orthogonal psi I. That's a common thing. It could be that psi I, F psi I is different for different I's. That's another way this could fail. Actually, those are the only two ways it could fail, basically. Yeah, okay, they're in some sense they're the same. Which actually brings up one of the other things I wanted to say, which is alternative versions of these quantum error correction conditions. Oh, but before I do that, let me explain the distance a little bit more. Okay, so because this is just one thing here instead of the product of two things, that means that a distance d code corrects d minus 1 over 2 errors. Qubits, errors on d minus 1 over 2 qubits. Why is that? Well, if you have an error on this many qubits, if your set of errors E is all errors on this many qubits, then the products EA dagger EB are operators on at most D minus 1 qubits. And therefore, psi I, EA dagger EB, psi J can't be not equal to this. It has to be equal to this, which is what we wanted. OK? But the other thing about this distance is that it also tells us about some other things. So a distance d code also corrects d minus 1 erasure errors. So why is that? Well, an erasure error, remember, or a located error, we know which qubit or qubits the errors are on. And so that means that the set of possible errors we have to think about are just errors on those set of qubits. And in that case, if we have EA dagger EB, well, it's still just going to be on those set of qubits, right? So if we have an erasure error on D minus 1 qubits, then EA dagger EB is still going to be on those D minus 1 qubits. And so if we have a code with distance D, we can correct those d minus 1 erasure errors. Okay, so correcting a general error where we don't know what it is like half as easy, or correcting erasure errors twice as easy in some sense. We can correct twice as many erasure errors as we can correct general errors. Okay? Okay, so then the very last thing is these alternative versions of this, these quantum error correction conditions. So one of them has been alluded to already, which is that if instead of picking a specific basis, you kind of go over all basis states, well, you have various different things you could do. So for one thing, you could just take arbitrary states psi and phi and say that instead of delta AB, this is supposed to equal to the correct inner product between psi and phi. That's not a very big change. But the other thing you can do is you can always use the same one. And, well, obviously, this is a special case of this. But if this is true for all psi in the code space, this is actually equivalent to this. That's not so obvious. You have to run over different possible, all the different possible psi's and look at superpositions to make that work out. So another version is you can kind of get rid of the same variation in the E's. And you can say, oh, let's look at this. And this has to be all E's in a linear span. Okay. And again, you do that by looking at different superpositions of, say, your basis EAs and making it work out. And then one final version, which is related to these erasure errors. And so it turns out that a quantum error correcting code corrects erasure errors on a particular set of qubits. If and only if, one version of it would be if trace rho E is independent, of logical state. So this is trace over S complement. So this one you can get pretty easily from this, right? You're saying, well, if E is some, so this is for E, no, I'm sorry. This is trace over everything for E acting on S, which is equivalent to saying that just trace over S complement of rho is independent of the logical state. So this one you can get from here, basically straightforwardly. You say, well, we have erasures on the set S, so E is acting on S, and this thing is this, independent of the state psi. And then you can get this one by saying, well, we'll just let E run over everything. That's saying actually the density matrix on the qubits of S has to be independent of the logical state. And that's a sufficient and necessary condition. And this, in particular, erasure errors are kind of important in where error correction shows up in these it for qubit topics. So I wanted to particularly call out this condition. Okay, so that's it for today.